The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by H.P. Lovecraft. Part 6. In the morning, Carter boarded the galleon bound for Celephias, and sat in the prow as the ropes were cast off, and the long sail down to the Serenarian Sea begun. For many leagues the banks were much as they were above Thran, with now and then a curious temple rising on the farther hills toward the right, and a drowsy village on the shore, with steep red roofs and nets spread in the sun. Mindful of his search, Carter questioned all the mariners closely about those whom they had met in the taverns of Celephias, asking the names and ways of the strange men with long narrow eyes, long-lobed ears, thin noses, and pointed chins, who came in dark ships from the north, and traded onyx for the carved jade and spun gold and little red singing birds of Celephias. Of these men the sailors knew not much, save that they talked but seldom, and spread a kind of awe about them. Their land, very far away, was called Inquanach, and not many people cared to go thither, because it was a cold twilight land, and said to be close to unpleasant Leng. Although high impassable mountains towered on the side where Leng was thought to lie, so that none might say whether this evil plateau, with its horrible stone villages and unmentionable monastery, were really there, or whether the rumor were only a fear that timid people felt in the night when those formidable barrier peaks loomed black against a rising moon. Certainly, men reached Leng from very different oceans. Of other boundaries of Inquanach, those sailors had no notion, nor had they heard of the cold waste and unknown Kadath, save from vague unplaced report. And of the marvelous sunset city which Carter sought, they knew nothing at all. So the traveller asked no more of far things, but bided his time, till he might talk with those strange men from cold and twilight Inquanach, who are the seed of such gods as carved their features on Ngronach. Late in the day the galleon reached those bends of the river which traverse the perfumed jungles of Kied. Here Carter wished he might disembark, for in those tropic tangles sleep wondrous palaces of ivory, lone and unbroken, where once dwelt fabulous monarchs of a land whose name is forgotten. Spells of the Elder Ones keep those places unharmed and undecayed, for it is written that there may one day be need of them again. And elephant caravans have glimpsed them from afar by moonlight, though none dares approach them closely, because of the guardians to which their wholeness is due. But the ships swept on, and dusk hushed the hum of the day, and the first stars above blinked answers to the early fireflies on the banks, as that jungle fell far behind, leaving only its fragrance as a memory that it had been. And all through the night that galleon floated on, past mysteries unseen and unsuspected. Once a lookout reported fires on the hills to the east, but the sleepy captain said, "It better not be looked at too much," for it was highly uncertain just who or what had lit them. In the morning the river had broadened out greatly, and Carter saw by the houses along the banks that they were close to the vast trading city of Flanith on the Serenarian Sea. Here the walls are of rugged granite, and the houses peakedly fantastic, with beamed and plastered gables. The men of Flanith are more like those of the waking world than any others in Dreamland, so that the city is not sought except for barter, but is prized for the solid work of its artisans. The wharves of Thlonith are of oak, and there the galleon made fast while the captain traded in the taverns. Carter also went ashore, and looked curiously upon the rutted streets where wooden ox-carts lumbered, and feverish merchants cried their wares vacuously in the bazaars. The sea-taverns were all close to the wharves, on cobbled lanes salted with the spray of high tides, and seemed exceedingly ancient, with their low black-beamed ceilings and casements of greenish bull's-eye panes. Ancient sailors in those taverns talked much of distant ports, and told many stories of the curious men from twilight Inquanaut, but had little to add to what the seamen of the galleon had told. Then at last, after much unloading and loading, the ship set sail once more over the sunset sea, and the high walls and gables of Thlonith grew less, as the last golden light of day lent them a wonder and beauty beyond any that men had given them. 2 nights and 2 days the galleon sailed over the Serenarian Sea, sighting no land, and speaking but one other vessel. Then, near sunset of the second day, there loomed up ahead the snowy peak of Aran, with its ginkgo trees swaying on the lower slope. And Carter knew that they were come to the land of Uth-Nargai, and the marvelous city of Celephias. Swiftly there came into sight the glittering minarets of that fabulous town, and the untarnished marble walls with their bronze statues, and the great stone bridge where Naraxa joins the sea. Then rose the gentle hills behind the town, with their groves and gardens of asphodels, and the small shrines and cottages upon them. And far in the background, the purple ridge of the Tenarians, potent and mystical, behind which lay forbidden ways into the waking world and toward other regions of dream. The harbor was full of painted galleys, some of which were from the marble cloud city of Saranian, that lies in ethereal space beyond where the sea meets the sky, and some of which were from more substantial parts of Dreamland. Among these, the steersman threaded his way up to the spice-fragrant wharves, where the galleon made fast in the dusk as the city's million lights began to twinkle out over the water. Ever new seemed this deathless city of vision, for here time has no power to tarnish or destroy. As it has always been, is still the turquoise of Nath-Horthoth, and the 80 orchid-wreathed priests are the same who builded it 10,000 years ago. Shining still is the bronze of the great gates, nor are the onyx pavements ever worn or broken. And the great bronze statues on the walls look down on merchants and camel drivers older than fable, yet without one gray hair in their forked beards. Carter did not once seek out the temple or the palace or the citadel, but stayed by the seaward wall among traders and sailors. And when it was too late for rumors and legends, he sought out an ancient tavern he knew well, and rested with dreams of the gods on unknown Kadath, whom he sought. The next day he searched all along the quays for some of the strange mariners of Inquanaut, but was told that none were now in port, their galley not being due from the north for full 2 weeks. He found, however, one Thorabonian sailor, who had been to Inquanaut, and had worked in the onyx quarries of that twilight place. And this sailor said There was certainly a desert to the north of the peopled region, which everybody seemed to fear and shun. The Thoribonian opined that this desert led around the utmost rim of impassable peaks into Leng's horrible plateau, and that this was why men feared it. Though he admitted that there were other vague tales of evil presences and nameless sentinels. Whether or not this could be the fabled waste wherein unknown Kadath stands, he did not know. But it seemed unlikely that those presences and sentinels, if indeed they existed, were stationed for naught. On the following day, Carter walked up the Street of the Pillars to the Turquoise Temple and talked with the High Priest. Though Nath-Horthath is chiefly worshipped in Celephias, all the great ones are mentioned in diurnal prayers, and the priest was reasonably versed in their moods. Like Atal in distant Ulthar, he strongly advised against any attempts to see them, declaring that they are testy and capricious, and subject to strange protection from the mindless other gods from outside, whose soul and messenger is the crawling chaos Nyarlathotep. Their jealous hiding of the marvelous Sunset City showed clearly that they did not wish Carter to reach it, and it was doubtful how they would regard a guest whose object was to see them and plead before them. No man had ever found Kadath in the past, and it might be just as well if none ever found it in future. Such rumors as were told about that onyx castle of the Great Ones were not by any means reassuring. Having thanked the orchid-crowned high priest, Carter left the temple and sought out the bazaar of the sheep butchers, where the old chief of Celephias cats dwelt sleek and contented. That gray and dignified being was sunning himself on the onyx pavement, and extended a languid paw as his caller approached. But when Carter repeated the passwords and introductions furnished him by the old cat general of Ulthar, the furry patriarch became very cordial and communicative, and told much of the secret lore known to cats on the seaward slopes of Uthnargai. Best of all, he repeated several things told him furtively by the timid waterfront cats of Celephias about the men of Inquanok, on whose dark ships no cat will go. It seems that these men have an aura not of earth about them, though this is not the reason why no cat will sail on their ships. The reason for this is that Inquanok holds shadows which no cat can endure, so that in all that cold twilight realm there is never a cheering purr or a homely mew. Whether it be because of things wafted over the impassable peaks from hypothetical Leng, or because of things filtering down from the chilly desert to the north, none may say. But it remains a fact that in that far land there broods a hint of outer space which cats do not like, and to which they are more sensitive than men. Therefore, they will not go on the dark ships that seek the basalt keys of Inquanok. The old chief of the cats also told him where to find his friend, King Kuranes, who in Carter's latter dreams had reigned alternately in the rose-crystal palace of the Seven Delights at Celephias, and in the turreted cloud castle of sky-floating Saranion. It seemed that he could no more find content in those places, but had formed a mighty longing for the English cliffs and downlands of his boyhood, where in little dreaming villages England's old songs hover at evening behind lattice windows, and where grey church towers peep lovely through the verdure of distant valleys. He could not go back to these things in the waking world, because his body was dead. But he had done the next best thing, and dreamed a small tract of such countryside in the region east of the city, where meadows roll gracefully up from the sea cliffs to the foot of the Tanarian hills. There he dwelt, in a grey Gothic manor house of stone, looking on the sea, and tried to think it was ancient Trevor Towers where he was born, and where 13 generations of his forefathers had first seen the light. And on the coast nearby he had built a little Cornish fishing village with steep cobbled ways, settling therein such people as had the most English faces, and seeking ever to teach them the dear remembered accents of old Cornwall fishers. And in a valley not far off he had reared a great Norman abbey, whose tower he could see from his window, placing around it in the churchyard grey stones with the names of his ancestors carved thereon, and with a moss somewhat like Old England's moss. For though Coronis was a monarch in the land of dream, with all imagined pomps and marvels, splendors and beauties, ecstasies and delights, novelties and excitements at his command, he would gladly have resigned forever the whole of his power and luxury and freedom, for one blessed day, as a simple boy, in that pure and quiet England, that ancient beloved England which had moulded his being, and of which he must always be immutably a part. So, when Carter bade that old grey chief of the cats adieu, he did not seek the terraced palace of rose crystal, but walked out the eastern gate and across the daisied fields toward a peaked gable which he glimpsed the oaks of a park sloping up to the sea cliffs. And in time he came to a great hedge and a gate with a little brick lodge, and when he rang the bell, there hobbled to admit him no robed and anointed lackey of the palace, but a small stubby old man in a smock, who spoke as best he could in the quaint tones of far Cornwall. And Carter walked up the shady path between trees, as near as possible to England's trees, and climbed the terraces among gardens set out as in Queen Anne's time. At the door, flanked by stone cats in the old way, he was met by a whiskered butler in suitable livery, and was presently taken to the library, where Coronis, Lord of Uthnargai and the sky around Saranian, sat pensive in a chair by the window, looking on his little sea-coast village, and wishing that his old nurse would come in and scold him because he was not ready for that hateful lawn party at the vicar's, with the carriage waiting and his mother nearly out of patience. Coronis, clad in a dressing-gown of the sort favoured by London tailors in his youth, rose eagerly to meet his guest, for the sight of an Anglo-Saxon from the waking world was very dear to him, even if it was a Saxon from Boston, Massachusetts, instead of from Cornwall. And for long they talked of old times, having much to say, because both were old dreamers and well versed in the wonders of incredible places. Coronis, indeed, had been out beyond the stars in the ultimate void, and was said to be the only one who had ever returned sane from such a voyage. At length Carter brought up the subject of his quest, and asked of his host those questions he had asked of so many others. Coronis did not know where Carath was, or the marvellous Sunset City, but he did know that the Great Ones were very dangerous creatures to seek out, and that the other gods had strange ways of protecting them from impertinent curiosity. He had learned much of the other gods in distant parts of space, especially in that region where form does not exist, and colored gases study the innermost secrets. The violet gas had told him terrible things of the crawling chaos Nyarlathotep, and had warned him never to approach the central void where the demon sultan Azathoth gnaws hungrily in the dark. Altogether, it was not well to meddle with the Elder Ones, and if they persistently denied all access to the marvelous Sunset City, it were better not to seek that city. Kuranis, furthermore, doubted whether his guest would profit aught by coming to the city, even were he to gain it. He himself had dreamed and yearned long years for lovely Celephias and the land of Uthnargai, and for the freedom and color and high experience of life devoid of its chains and conventions and stupidities. But now that he was come into that city and that land, and was the king thereof, he had found the freedom and the vividness all too soon worn out, and monotonous for want of linkage with anything firm in his feelings and memories. He was a king in Uthnargai, but found no meaning therein, and drooped always for the old familiar things of England that had shaped his youth. All his kingdom would he give for the sound of Cornish church bells over the downs, and all the thousand minarets of Celephias for the steep homely roofs of the village near his home. So he told his guest that the unknown Sunset City might not hold quite that content he sought, and that perhaps it had better remain a glorious and half-remembered dream. For he had visited Carter often in the old waking days, and knew well the lovely New England slopes that had given him birth. At the last, he was very certain, the seeker would long only for the early remembered scenes. The glow of Beacon Hill at evening, the tall steeples and winding hill streets of quaint Kingsport, the hoary gambrel roofs of ancient and witch-haunted Arkham, and the blessed meads and valleys where stone walls rambled and white farmhouse gables peeked out from bowers of verdure. These things he told Randolph Carter, but still the seeker held to his purpose. And in the end they parted, each with his own conviction. And Carter went back through the bronze gate into Celephias and down the street of pillars to the old sea wall, where he talked more with the mariners of far ports, and waited for the dark ship from cold and twilight in Quannock, whose strange-faced sailors and onyx traders had in them the blood of the Great Ones. End of Part 6.